I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The new leader of the Kansas Child Welfare Agency is up against a long list of challenges. Too many kids in foster care, staffing issues across the state, and double the number of abuse and neglect issues compared to other states. Today, meet the woman taking on those challenges. That's Laura Howard. She's been immersed in this field for 30 years. I'll ask why she wanted the top job. Then, included in the vast collection of art at the Nelson Atkins Museum are a number of pieces that were stolen by the Nazis in World War II. We'll focus on some of that art and learn how it ended up in Kansas City. And Thursday is Weekend To-Do List Day. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Ask reporters to list the toughest jobs in Kansas, and one that will pop up almost every single time is Secretary of the Kansas Department of Children and Families. The list of challenges is long. Too many kids in foster care, sky-high vacancy rates in department offices across the state, the number of abuse and neglect investigations are said to be double that of other states. It's a lot of stuff, and that's what Laura Howard has taken on as the new leader of the agency. She most recently worked for the University of Kansas, where she was a director of the Public Management Center in the School of Public Affairs and Administration. Prior to that, she held senior positions in the department, and it's a pleasure to have her here. Laura, welcome to Up to Date.
It's nice to be here with you, Steve.
You know, full disclosure, you know, 30 years ago, as a young pup reporter in Topeka, I covered you, and you were, I think, a budget analyst for the state, and I was always so impressed by the way all the answers you had to give to lawmakers who wanted to know the ins and outs of the social services budget. And so I guess my first take is the state might be in very good hands with you at the helm. So it's a pleasure to see you again here.
Thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I got to ask, why did you want the job?
You know, I've spent my entire career in public service, and as you indicated, much of that time in human services. And, you know, I feel really in a lot of ways that it's just really a calling and something that I felt like I really needed to do. I've been really concerned as a citizen outside the system for the last 8 years at some of the changes that I've seen happen,
right.
Really concerned about the number of youth in foster care, and just really felt like it was my turn to step up and take that on. And I was really pleased that Governor asked me to do that.
You knew what you were getting into because you've held, as I said, a number of senior positions in this department. So, you know, you had a sense of what you were biting off here.
I did. As you said, I've been a deputy secretary in what was then the Department of Social and Rehabilitation Services.
Right.
Dealt with lots of big issues there. So, no, I walk into the role with my eyes wide open, knowing that there's lots of things across all the program areas that we really need to give attention to, particularly in child welfare.
Yeah, I gather that there are so many issues here that solving these things overnight, that's not going to happen here.
It's not. I've told my staff that I feel like our work together and our work with our partners is really about a marathon, but really a marathon that's made up of a lot of sprints. So we're going to
sprint and marathon. Yeah.
Some pauses maybe on those sprints, set some real targets and really move forward to accomplish those. And, you know, I view it as really a process of continuous improvement.
You know, how big is the Department of Children and Families? How many employees just roughly do you oversee? Laura.
There's about 2,600 employees, and most of those are spread across the state in our four regions in 36 offices across the state.
So 2,600 employees.
2,600.
Wow. Let's go to some of the challenges that you face, because again, there's so many. One is you need more people to do the work you do to service the hotline when emergencies arise in families and to have more investigators on staff to lower caseloads. Are you able to start hiring yet?
We have. We've aggressively started hiring, and Governor Kelly has really supported that effort in her budget proposal by adding 26 staff in the current year and proposing an additional 26 for a total of 52 in 2020. So we've aggressively started hiring those positions already. And I'll tell you, I've been really pleased with how effective we've been in recruitment. We have a goal at the Protection Report Center, that hotline you talked about, to have no vacancies by April 1st, and we're well on our way to reaching that goal.
I'm wondering if 50-plus employees, is that going to be enough to fill the gaps you have in your agency, Laura?
You know, I think it's a good start. As we look at investigator caseloads, that will get us closer, but not quite to, you know, what the preferred average is based on national child welfare standards, but it'll get us close. I think it's a good start.
You know, your predecessor in the job had begun hiring workers who weren't necessarily licensed social workers. Are you going to continue that practice, or do you believe that credential is necessary to work at DCF?
You know, a little bit of both, Steve. I think right now we're continuing to retain the employees we have that have various credentials. And I won't rule out continuing to hire some that aren't social workers, but I'm putting more emphasis on getting more social workers in those seats. So we have some aggressive recruitment campaigns with the schools of social work across the state. We've reached out to bring in a lot more students and interns, and have had some real success even just this semester with those students wanting to stay on as workers in the agency.
Your predecessor, again, Gina Meyer-Hummel, what she was hiring non-social work people because I guess she didn't think there was enough of a supply of those folks in the state to hire those people.
It's tough. There is a social work shortage across the state. You see it in child welfare. You see it in state hospitals. You see it all over. But for example, there's a number of initiatives. The legislature is working on a bill to allow reciprocity that the Kansas Association of Social Workers has supported that would help, for example, folks from Missouri who have credentials as social workers to come into Kansas more easily.
You know, so once April comes and you've made some hires here, Laura, will you have enough people to check on the welfare of kids in foster families and group homes and the like across the state?
I think we will, Steve. And again, the focus really of our workers is really that very, very front end services, the hotline, and then investigating those reports of abuse and neglect. And then on the other side, we have responsibilities then to monitor and oversee the contractors that we've hired for the foster care case management and family preservation services.
As you well know, the concern in Kansas has been that caseloads have been so high. Are those, you're saying, are going to drop down to more acceptable levels?
They're getting better, particularly for our investigators. They're already getting better. They're in the range of 15 to 17 in the last report that I saw. You know, I'd like to, over the course of my tenure, get those down closer to 12, but they're inching down. So I think we're able to make some good progress.
And they've been as high in Kansas in recent years as 30, 40, 50, right?
That's
somewhere
correct.
In that range?
That's
yeah.
correct.
What about the high vacancy rates in your department, and what's been causing that, and are you able to pay more now?
Two things that I would say about that. One, a symptom just of limited resources within the state budget. And second, just the challenges with recruitment and retention. So we have made some modest increases in the salaries that we're paying to critical workers in the agency. But we're also trying to institute some initiatives that are really about retention. You know, one of the things I think is important is making sure that people have the tools they need to do their job. And I'm not sure that we've done the best job that we can do to equip those new workers who come in. This is the hardest work that someone can do. Hmm. You know, taking those hotline calls, investigating those reports of abuse and neglect. And so we're really looking at initiatives for how we can better take care of our workers, equip them at the front end, and really support them as they're doing that really, really difficult work.
Laura Howard, the new head of the Department of Children and Families in Kansas, is my guest. You know, DCF has been scrutinized over the awarding of service grants that didn't go through the normal process, especially with regard to a Florida-based company called Eckert Connects. That happened under previous leadership, Secretary Gina Meyer-Hummel, who's been here before as a guest, and Governor Kelly has canceled those grants. I guess the question now is, who's going to manage Kansas foster care moving forward?
Okay, so two things. There's family preservation grants and foster care grants. On the family preservation side, as you indicated, Governor Kelly canceled those grants. An RFP actually has just been issued today to rebid those grants. So
and what does family preservation do, Laura?
Yeah, family preservation is an intensive service that's designed to serve people in their homes, provide parenting skills, skills to assist parents in taking care of their children so they don't have to come into the foster care system at all.
So keep families together,
keep families
kids with
together.
Their parents.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So
then
we're rebidding that. That's right. And so we'll continue with our current family preservation contractors for 6 months during that rebidding process. And then we'll see what happens in that process. On the foster care side of the equation, we didn't have the same concerns as we did with the family preservation award. So, but I did want to make some changes around accountability in that system. So we're bringing back those entities that bid. We're extending the current foster care contracts for 3 months while we negotiate those new contracts. So effective October 1st, we will have our existing foster care contractors and then also a couple new ones working in the state.
I'm wondering about the need for more foster parents in the state. I always hear there's such a chronic shortage of folks who are willing to do that work. Where do we stand with that?
You know, you can never have enough foster parents, but we have really strong child placing agencies, which are really the entities that recruit foster parents across the state. Part of the stress right now in the system is not so much that we don't have enough foster families. It's that we have so many youth in foster care, really a disproportionate amount.
7,300 was the last number I saw.
That's right. That's right. It's in the range of 7,300.
And that's way more than other states, at least proportionally speaking,
right?
It
is. I saw some data the other day that, you know, like 10.8 out of 1,000 kids in Kansas is in foster care. And when you look across the country, it's 5.8. So we're not double, but almost double. So
that's
stress and strain. Why is that?
Yeah.
You know, I would attribute that the increase to several things. If you go back just to 2011, we only had just over 5,000 youth in foster care. So I think one of the biggest factors has been the changes in policies related to the state safety net programs, where restrictions were put on cash assistance for families, really restrictive time limits. And I can't sit here today and say that that caused the increase, but there's certainly a correlation in seeing the numbers of families receiving those cash benefits go down from about 39,000 families to 9,000, and the number of children in foster care going up. So I think that's
parents,
one factor.
So parents simply saying perhaps they can't afford to look after their own kids.
Or just having more risk factors in their families. And remember, too, not every child who comes into foster care is a victim of abuse and neglect. There are a lot of families who we call them family in need of services. They're non-abuse neglect cases. Maybe there's issues with parenting skills. Maybe there's issues with adequacy of food in the home, those kinds of things. So I definitely see a correlation with the reduction on the safety net side. And I think, too, because the numbers are so high in the system and because there's been so much stress in the system, it's also been more difficult to move children through in a more timely manner. So I think we have issues on the front end and the back end that we're looking to address.
I was going to say to lower that number of kids would take a lot of pressure off the system and your department, right?
Right. And that front end is really a huge focus for us, is really taking a look at that.
Being more selective about kids who are allowed into the foster care system.
Yes, being more focused on what services could be provided to children in their family settings to keep them safely at home instead of entering the foster care system.
You know, some say, Laura, that the high number of kids could be the root of what led to this class action lawsuit against DCF in November. The suit alleges that your agency, again, before you were a board, violated foster children's civil rights by moving them around too often, adding to their trauma and restricting their access to mental health treatment. This also happened at Regina Meyer Hummel's watch, but can you talk about how the agency is responding to those charges?
Sure. You're right. A class action lawsuit has been filed against the state. And of course, we're in the process, kind of through the legal process of responding to that. But the very issues that are alleged in the lawsuit are the things that we're seeking to address. For example, issues around placement stability. You already talked about that, how the high number of kids really contributes to that. So
And then they're
our
moved around too often, is what the lawsuit alleges.
With the stresses and strains in the system, the ability to find that right home that matches for that child in the first place, we're bringing on a placement matching system that will come on board by October that will allow for better matches. The front-end preventative services that we're looking to implement will give just more options to, again, to provide services to keep those youth out of care. So we've got some smaller numbers within foster care, and so we can manage that better. I think also on the placement stability side, we're really looking closely at some initiatives to expand the use of kinship care. So we're able to really be more focused at the very front end in identifying those relatives who might be a good fit for a child
Ah,
who's coming into custody.
instead of being removed and taken into the state custody, they would be moved to a relative's house or something like that.
They could be, or even if they came into custody, that their placement might be with a relative. And there's some really innovative models that are out there, innovative kinship navigator models that really seek to provide the supports those relatives might need to deal with some of the issues, say maybe some teenagers who might be kind of out of control might be facing, and really to provide more supports than have maybe typically been provided to relatives if they're willing to step up and take that on.
Again, Laura Howard is my guest. She's the new Secretary of the Department of Children and Families in the state of Kansas. She was selected by Governor Laura Kelly. There were a lot of stories, news stories, the last couple of years about kids who were spending the night in department offices across the state because they couldn't be placed fast enough. Where does that issue stand?
That issue has really gotten under control. We've worked really, really hard with our contractors to ensure that that happens on in only very, very rare circumstances. So in the last, I think since November, there's only been a couple of incidents where that's happened. And one of those was entirely attributed to weather and an icy night, and it really wasn't safe to drive the children anywhere. Now, I would say that doesn't necessarily mean that the children aren't that the children are in as stable a placements as I'd like. It just means that the contractors have really looked at other alternatives rather than keeping those children in offices. But they may not yet be in their permanent foster home. So my point is, there's still work to do, but we're certainly making sure that they're in more appropriate placements rather than spending the night in
So
offices.
the number of kids on any given night who might be lodged in an office across the state would be what these days?
It's really been zero, except for two incidents in
Oh.
the last 4 months, and again, one of which
Wow.
was weather related.
There were also stories about children in foster care who were wandering away from families and couldn't be accounted for. I get it that those situations crop up in every state, but where do we stand now with that issue?
Well, we've taken a number of steps, and I would actually credit the prior administration with some steps that Secretary Meyer-Hummel initiated. So there are currently two investigators on staff at DCF whose entire job is to investigate those children who have run away from their foster care placements or who are missing from their placement. That they spend their time doing that. They use social media. They talk to friends. We have daily reports about those children. When I looked at the report yesterday, there were 69 youth. Most of those were 16 or 17 years old, I think 50 or more. The remainder were 13 to 15. And typically, when as we find those youth, in many, many cases, they've tried to go back home. They've tried to go to their parents. They might be at friends' houses, from the community that they come from, things like that. So those investigators are working closely with police and just being very, very aggressive in seeking those youth who've left those placements. And I might mention on this, we've now also, at the initiative of Governor Kelly, we're actually posting that report on our website every
Huh,
day.
no
And we're
kidding.
also notifying local media from counties where youth are missing. Not the names of the youth, because we have some confidentiality issues, but some characteristics of those youth so the word can get out there in a more public way as well.
So you'd like the public's help and support. in tracking down these kids and letting you know where they are, perhaps.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, transparency seems to be a hallmark of what you're bringing to this agency as you get started here. Talk about that. Why is that important, and what are you trying to do?
You know, from someone who spent, you know, my whole career in government, working in, for the legislature and working in the executive branch, I've always felt like that you really can't have strong government without transparent government. I think government can only operate well when you're honest about how things are, and when you're then working together, you know, across branches of government with stakeholders and partners to make those improvements. So to me, it's just kind of inherent. And I think there's been a lot of issues in the last few years where there's been perceptions and reality of lack of transparency across a number of systems in the state.
Mm-hmm.
So I think from my perspective, we're doing everything we can to be as transparent as we can, to be open about the problems. And that's with our communication, not just with, you know, legislators, but also with stakeholders and partners. We all need to work together. We can't do this difficult work of child welfare on our own. We need stakeholders. We need partners. We need people in the community to really all step up and be part of that solution for kids.
You know, Laura, I'm just so struck by the fact that you oversee thousands of employees, thousands of children, many of whom are in vulnerable predicaments. What keeps you up at night? What do you worry about?
I do worry about those kids. No, it's been interesting to me taking on the role of secretary of the agency, because certainly I've worked in the agency before, had lots of responsibilities, but I'm very, very aware as a secretary that those kids are in my custody. So I think about that. That does keep me up at night. When I hear about a child that's gone missing, when I hear about, you know, perhaps struggles our workers are having, or failure to meet timelines or things like that, those things that really impact the lives of kids, that's what keeps me up every night. Really thinking about those are my kids, those are our kids.
That's Laura Howard. She's the new secretary of the Kansas Department of Children and Families. We wish you the best of luck. A lot of people are rooting for you out there to get this agency turned around and keep going, and come back and see us, okay?
Great. Thank you. I'd love to talk to you next year about what we've accomplished.
Sounds
thank
good.
You.
Again, Laura Howard, of the Secretary of the Department of Children and Families in Kansas. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about Nazi art that's found its way, once held by the Nazis, that's found its way to the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we learned how farmers and agricultural communities would be affected by the president's proposed $3 billion budget cut to the Ag Department. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow is Friday, thank goodness, and we'll have a little bad news before your weekend. Your tax refund might be smaller than expected this year. The good news is we'll ask tax pros about what changes you might want to make when filing. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, it's no secret that included in the vast collection at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art are a number of pieces once stolen by the Germans during Hitler's time. In fact, an exhibit at the museum, Discriminating Thieves, Nazi-Looted Art and Restitution, focuses on this aspect of the museum's works. Now, a conversation about the path that some of these works of art took to get to Kansas City and what was behind the Nazis' art acquisition program. And just for the record, all the pieces were talking about today came to the museum with clear title and are rightfully part of the museum's collection. With us, Mackenzie Mallon is a specialist in provenance for the Nelson Atkins. She's also the author of A Refuge from War, the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, and the Evacuation of Art to the Midwest during World War II. Mackenzie, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
How many pieces now in the Nelson Atkins are known to have been looted by the Nazis?
We know of seven at this point. Our research is always continuing. We have four of them in the exhibition.
No, and so the number could go up with time.
It could. You know, this research takes a lot of time, and it's very detailed. So, you know, there are possibly stories that we still need to uncover.
And how do you know about these four pieces, their history? How were you able to determine all this?
Yeah, so the exhibition Discriminating Thieves really came out of the research that I do on the ownership history of the collection or
that's
the provenance.
That's what provenance is,
that's
right?
That's right. And so just over the last several years, I recognized that these particular works shared this common history of having been looted by the Nazis during World War II. And when we realized that they had this shared history, we thought it would be a great opportunity to discuss the research we do into the provenance of our collection in the form of an exhibition.
What is that research? Like, how do you even begin to determine where a piece of art might have been at one point in time?
It can be challenging. It can be difficult.
You're a detective, essentially,
right? It is. It's kind of like detective work.
Yeah.
That's true. We literally have to scour the globe for records into where these objects were, who owned them, when they owned them, where they were, and how they changed hands. And information like that can be in an archive in Austria, or it can be in a record-keeping place in L.A., or it could be right here in Kansas City in our own museum. So it really takes a lot of detailed, painstaking research, and it's something that can take years of our time, but it's such an important part of how we take care of the collections in the museum.
I was going to say, how do you even know where to go to find that information? But I imagine you must, folks like you have certain repositories you know about around the globe where this information is stored.
That's right. So there are quite a number of larger repositories in certain countries, depending on what you're looking for. In Los Angeles, there's a really big one at the Getty Museum. I use the National Archives in Washington, D.C. a lot, especially when I'm researching the Nazi period, because of all the military records, the records from the Monuments Men and the Allies for recovering the art are all stored there.
Let's slow down just for a half a second here and remind everybody, give them some context about what we're talking about. How much art did the Germans seize during the war? What did they do with it? What do we know about all that?
So there are a lot of different estimates about how much art was seized. It was certainly in the hundreds of thousands, by some estimations in the millions, and that kind of depends on how you define the numbers, but
right.
It was certainly a lot of art.
Because the Nazis knew there was great value here. You were taking the soul out of other cultures by taking the art. Does that sort of go without saying?
That's true. So there's a long tradition in war of looting the cultures that you conquer. And the Nazis were no exception to this. Certainly, Hitler stole art for a number of reasons. He saw art as a status symbol for himself. He wanted to create the greatest art museum in the world. He called it the Führer Museum. And one of the
course he did.
That's right, of course. And one of the objects in our exhibition, a painting by the artist Arlo Juliere, was actually slated to be a part of the Führer Museum. So there was that aspect of the theft for this museum. Certainly the Nazi leadership wanted to build their own private collections. Hermann Göring, who was head of the Luftwaffe, was really big on acquiring works for his own personal collection. Mm. And then we get into what the Nazis considered to be degenerate art, or art that they considered to be detrimental to the morality of Germany.
And they wanted to eliminate it, right?
They wanted to get rid of it, to either destroy it outright, and certainly thousands of works that were declared degenerate were destroyed by the Nazi regime, or to sell it in order to raise funds for the Reich. Because, of course, under Hitler, in all aspects of war, it's all about what or who he can use to further his own aims. So this degenerate art really was mostly categorized by modern art, expressionism, surrealism, art that Hitler really didn't understand and targeted.
Mackenzie Mellon is my guest. She's a specialist in provenance for the Nelson Atkins. We're talking about a new exhibit at the Nelson Atkins, Discriminating Thieves, Nazi Looted Art and Restitution. It's on exhibit at the museum through January. For our museum hours, go to nelson-atkins.org. Okay, did they take more paintings and sculptures, or what did they focus on back in those days in terms of the looting of art that they did?
Certainly, they took a lot of paintings. I think that was the top priority. You know, Hitler himself was a failed artist, and he specialized in watercolor paintings.
That's right.
So his priority was paintings, also sculptures, but also taking decorative arts, even what we would consider household objects. They looted everything that they could. But in the museum research, we prioritize paintings and sculptures. Mostly because those objects are oftentimes unique objects. When you get into things like prints or bronze sculptures, that kind of thing, they can be produced in multiples and more difficult to research.
And what happened then right after the war, Mackenzie, to get the art back to its rightful owners? I mean, give us the Reader's Digest version there, because there was a massive effort to get this all squared away.
Yes. So right at the end of the war, the Allies started uncovering these huge stashes of art that the Nazis had looted, and they took it from those castles and salt mines where it was stored, and sent them all to what they called collecting points, where they could categorize it and figure out where it all belonged. And then they returned the art to the countries of origin. And then it was those countries' responsibility to return it to the individuals. And that's where we get into the story of the Monuments Men, and that was told in numerous different films in the last few years.
Yeah. And to what extent did the art get back to its rightful owners? What do we know about that?
So the Monuments Men were certainly very successful in restoring art to their rightful owners. Most of it was returned. A lot of it wasn't, for a variety of reasons. You have to think about, especially with Jewish art collectors, in some cases there was no one left from the family to return the art to.
So what would happen with that art then?
In most cases, that art, it would be returned to the country that it was stolen from, and usually became a part of the collections of that country's national museums. So, for example, in France, in the Louvre has one gallery that's dedicated to showing art that has not been able to be returned to its rightful owner, just in the hopes that maybe someone will come into that gallery and recognize something that was once in their family.
So that's still an ongoing process even today, so many years after the war.
It is, and I think it's something that's probably never ending.
Well, let's take one piece of art in this exhibit, Discriminating Thieves. This is a still life of roses in a vase. Tell us about this piece. Who was the artist, and what year was the piece created?
This painting was done by the late 19th, early 20th century artist Pierre Bonnard in France. It was owned by Jewish banker David Vey, who lived in Paris before the war. It was stolen from his home in Paris and shuttled between shuttled between numerous different storage repositories during the war. And after the war was uncovered in a salt mine in Altasse, Austria, by the Allies in May of 1945.
Where the Nazis had stored it.
That's right. They stored a lot of art in mines, because those locations being so far underground, it would be protected from bombing. There was often a lot of space. They would be kind of out of the way and in the countryside. But also, they usually had constant temperature and humidity. Mm-hmm. And although the conditions may not have been museum quality, the key there is the constants of those conditions.
It's amazing the stories that some of these pieces, what they've gone through, and the fact that they still survive today. Should we be amazed by that, given the history here?
I'm amazed by it every day.
Yeah, I get it.
We uncover amazing stories all the time. And to me, it's so exciting to walk through the museum and to know a little bit about what I call the other art history of the collection. You know, you think about art history as the artist and the style and the time in which the artist was creating the works. And that's so important. But there's another side to the collection as well. It's where the collection was before it came to us. Mm-hmm. And these stories are so interesting.
Do you know when this piece, particular piece of a still life of roses in a vase, when it was looted by the Nazis?
It was looted in 1943, I believe.
And when it was found in the salt mine, would that have been 45 or 46?
45, May of 45.
So right when the war was ending.
And it was returned in 46 to David Vey, and his family kept it until the 70s. And at that point, his heirs decided to put it up for sale, and it was bought by two collectors here in Kansas City, Herman and Helen Sutherland, who bought it at a dealer in Paris and brought it back to KC. And upon Helen Sutherland's passing in 2004, they generously bequeathed it to the museum. So that's how it came into our collection.
So what a roundabout path for that particular piece of art. How do you tell these stories in the exhibit, Mackenzie? How do you relate all this to people who are coming through?
One of the funnest parts of the exhibition to me is our digital interactive. So it gives the visitor an opportunity to explore the history of every object in the collection in as little or as much depth as they want, using photographs, videos. We have some animated maps where you can follow the path that the paintings took and the artworks took during the war, and also scans of documents that we've uncovered during the research from both the American and Allied sides, also from the German side. So you can see the documentation that goes behind the looting and the restitution of the artworks.
Have you had a moment, as in the work that you do, where when you've come across a great find and you've sort of jumped off your seat? Do you have moments like that in what you do?
I think the first work of art that I discovered that had this history, that had been looted by the Nazis, I think I jumped out of my chair.
Tell me about that. What piece was it?
It was the painting by L'Argelier, Augustus the Strong, which is in the exhibition. And I had recently acquired a book called Hitler's Museum. It had just been published, and it was a very large tome of reproductions of photo albums that were created for Hitler, of the works that had been captured and were slated for the Führer Museum.
And he was going to check off which ones were worthy of his museum.
That's right. His officers would put together these photo albums of works that they'd confiscated and give him these albums, like, for his birthday, as gifts. And there's 30-some-odd albums in existence. And so this book reproduced as many of these albums that we've been able to find. And I was just literally just flipping through the pages thinking, oh, wow, this is really interesting. And I stopped on a page that our painting was illustrated on.
And you recognized it.
I recognized it. And my first thought was, wait a minute, there's no way. Because we know the background of this painting. It's not looted by the Nazis. Of course not. You know, we know where it was. It's from the Rothschild collection.
Yeah.
And it turned out that, yeah, it was. It was in the Rothschild collection before the war, and it was looted, and then it was returned to the Rothschilds after the war. So while we did know the provenance of the picture, we didn't know this little sidestep.
Give me some more context here. Hasn't there been some concern across the globe about museums that are still holding pieces of art that do, in fact, rightfully belong to someone else, and they've wound up there sort of the wrong way?
There is always a concern that something in the collection might not have that we might not have clear title to something in the collection. That's why we do this research. And that's why at the Nelson Atkins, we are proactive in the research, because we believe that it's better to be proactive than reactive.
Yeah,
we would
that.
Rather research the collection and know where it came from.
And you
from.
Guys be the ones to find out if there's an issue instead of somebody
Absolutely.
Coming to you.
And then we can do the right thing and move forward with that. It's so much better to be on the proactive side.
Have some museums gotten caught up in this, though, and not been proactive? They've been more reactive?
You know,
and paid a price for that?
Provenance research is something that takes a long, long time, and it takes money, too. You have to be able to travel to these different archives. It can take years to research just a single work of art. So I think some museums that have seemingly in the media been caught with works of art that have this history and they didn't know about previously, it's not always that they didn't know about it. It's that they didn't get there yet. And I think that's something that we need to understand when we're talking about this topic, is that this stuff is painstaking and it's going to take decades for us to complete this kind of research. And what we really need is the resources to do so.
Now, you have a piece of degenerate art coming, congratulations, in the exhibit. So the Nazis didn't destroy the work, this one piece. What piece is this, and what happened to it?
So this is our painting titled Masks. It's by the artist Emil Nolde. Nolde was actually a Nazi party member, and he enjoyed the patronage of several high-ranking Nazi officials, including Joseph Goebbels, before the war started. Yes.
But even that didn't get him
but
across the bar of degenerate art.
But even that did not protect him. No, yeah. It didn't protect him from Hitler's ideas of what is good art and what is bad art. And so this particular painting was taken out of a museum in Essen, Germany, and given to one of the four German dealers that were tasked with selling degenerate art outside of Germany.
Hmm. And how did it wind up at the Nelson Atkins?
It was kept by this particular dealer. His name was Carl Buchholz until after the war. He never actually sold it. And then in September 1948, representatives from different German museums got together to consider the fact that 21,000 works of art had been removed from German museums as degenerate. They realized that it would be
21,000.
21,000. Can you imagine?
Is there a pattern in what these pieces look like? Do we know what Hitler regarded as a little bit off-putting and what he didn't like?
Yeah, they're mostly really the cream of what was at the time a really avant-garde period of German art. Hitler was taking works of art that were groundbreaking. His country was on the cusp of a new type of modern art, and he was just ripping it out of his country. So this was mostly expressionism and things that were a little more abstract, art that dealt with some uncomfortable subjects. He wanted art that glorified Germany, glorified the people, glorified the landscape. So this particular painting was earmarked as degenerate. And when the German museum leaders got together and realized it'd be impossible to get all of this back, they relinquished ownership of the degenerate art. And so the dealer that had our painting, Buchholz, was free to sell it. And so this was in September of 1948, and he sent it to a colleague of his in New York. And when that colleague passed away in 1954, it was still in his dealership. Mm-hmm. And his assistant was from Kansas City. And she contacted the museum, and
there you go.
That's the end of the story.
Mackenzie Mallon, the exhibit Discriminating Thieves, Nazi Looted Art and Restitution on display at the Nelson Atkins through January. Great stories, Mackenzie. Thanks for coming in and sharing them with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Tomorrow we sit down with a Queer Eye contestant from Kansas. He'll talk about his time in the spotlight and what's changed for him since the filming. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.